This episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by the Tyrannosaurus Rex. The T-Rex. Whether you're 2 or 102, it's completely awesome. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is about the Tyrannosaurus feathers. You're about to hear the first on-location interview recorded for the Children's Literature Podcast. Co-host Chloe and I drove up from Leicestershire to Nottingham to visit Woolerton Hall, the home of the Nottingham Natural History Museum. You may have seen this beautiful building on the silver screen acting as Wayne Manor in a Batman film, but inside, instead of the Batcave, there are dinosaur bones and bird's eggs and dioramas of rare undersea creatures. And it's all watched over by the curator, Dr. Adam S. Smith, who has co-written a new children's picture book, The Tyrannosaurus Feathers, with Jonathan Emmett, a prolific writer of children's books, and an author I interviewed back in February as part of my series on Leicestershire children's writers. The text of the Tyrannosaurus feathers is as funny as it is interesting, but it can only come to life thanks to the brilliant illustrations of Stephen Vanderporten, whose work brings energy, movement, and humor to every page. Woolerton Hall is a wonderful place to visit, and I hope that one day you get the chance to see its interesting scientific collection, the beautiful deer park that surrounds it, and the pretty darn good cafes over in the stable block. There's a really good play park, too. The zip line is excellent. Our interview took place in the library, where Chloe and I enjoyed the atmosphere created by the way our voices echoed in the beautiful high-ceilinged room, and the faint smell of old leather coming from the books. Dr. Smith and Mr. Emmett were very generous hosts during our conversation, and I hope that you pick up a copy of The Tyrannosaurus Feathers, which will be published this week. Your kids will certainly thank you if you do. And now, please enjoy a conversation between myself, co-host Chloe Townsend, Dr. Adam S. Smith, and Jonathan Emmett. Chloe and I are here at Woolerton Hall in Nottingham. It's a former grand country house that's now a natural history museum. It's surrounded by park grounds, which are full of deer and beautiful old trees. And it's a wonderful place to have a conversation with Jonathan Emmett and Dr. Adam S. Smith, authors of the delightful new book, The Tyrannosaurus Feathers.
Mr. Emmett and Dr. Smith, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having us on the show. We're very pleased to be part of it.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming to Woolerton Hall.
Jonathan, we've spoken before. You were featured back in February as part of my series on children's writers from Leicestershire, but go ahead and remind listeners about yourself and your work.
So I was originally born in Leicestershire, now live in Nottinghamshire, not that far from Woolerton Hall, a short cycle ride. And I started off as an architect, did that for a few years, but I've always wanted to be a children's author. And these days, I'm mostly a picture book author. So the books that I've done with Adam are both picture books, but I also do a bit of paper engineering, which means that I design novelty books and pop-up books and things like that. Possibly my best known picture book is Bringing Down the Moon.
Dr. Adam Smith, did you become a paleontologist as an act of rebellion against your parents who clearly wanted you to be an economist?
No, I get that a lot. My grandmother is Scottish as well, so I do have a connection to the other more famous Adam Smith. But no, my parents were really encouraging when I was interested in dinosaurs and fossils when I was really young. My dad used to take me out fossil hunting around the UK, so I've got a small collection of fossils that I gathered, and I've still got that now. So they were always encouraging and convinced me that it was worth following my dream, and that's why I went to university and became a paleontologist.
It's funny that so many kids, when they're little, love dinosaurs and say, what job would you like to be? They say a paleontologist, but so few of them actually grow up to become paleontologists. You're one of the lucky few, Adam.
This is the second book you have written together. How did you two meet and begin collaborating?
So a few years ago, I did a picture book called How the Borks Became, which was written to introduce evolution to primary school aged children, because it's only just started to be taught in primary schools and it's right at the top end of primary schools, and I wanted it to be taught right at the beginning because I think evolution is one of the most important sort of facts about life. So I wrote this book, and I'd never had a book launch before, but I was really proud of this book, and so I thought I'm going to try and have a book launch for it. And I thought the best place to have a book launch that I could think of was this Natural History Museum, because I've been coming here since my children were small, so about sort of 20, 30 years. I love Wollaston Hall. And so I rather cheekily got in touch with the hall to ask if I could have my book launch here. And that got me in touch with Adam. And I'm glad to say Adam agreed to let me launch the book here. And it's how we got to know each other. So after I'd got to know Adam a little bit better, he mentioned to me that he was an expert in plesiosaurs, and that there was a blog post on his website, plesiosauria.com, that was looking at the different explanations scientists have come up with for the very long necks that lots of plesiosaurs have. And Adam said, I think this might make a picture book. And usually when people say that to me, I kind of go, because it's usually a terrible idea. but in this case, I thought, you know, that sounds really interesting. And so I gave Adam a few tips on how he might turn it into a picture book. But even as I was giving him those tips, I was thinking, oh, I really hope he asks me to write it with him. And Adam did go away, wrote a first draft of the book. But after writing the first draft, Adam did ask me to write The Plesiosaur's Neck, that's what the book was called, with him. And we've been friends ever since, and we've been writing together ever since.
Jonathan, you get paid to write about dinosaurs. Adam, you get paid to study about dinosaurs. You are living the dream of every child. What advice would you give to children who have a dinosaur career one day?
So, I work as a curator of natural history here at the Wollaston Hall Nottingham Natural History Museum. My main job, you know, I work part-time, so part of the week I work as a curator, and the other part of the week I write children's picture books. When I'm here as a curator, I don't actually get the opportunity to do much in the way of research, unfortunately. Some curators do have research as part of their job remit, but unfortunately I don't. So most of my actual day job, although it's working with fossils in our collection, it's mostly looking after them, caring for them, and working on displays for them and putting them into new galleries and exhibitions. So I suppose you could think of that as studying fossils, but it's more really about interpreting the fossils at a more basic level for the general public to be able to enjoy the fossil collections that we have here and all of the other natural history collections here as well. So although paleontology is my specialism, that's my academic background, today I'm much more of a generalist curator. So I look after the fossil collection here in the museum, but I also look after taxidermy collections of mounted animal skins. We've got a herbarium collection of 100,000 pressed plants. We've got lots of things like bird eggs. We've got things like jellyfish that are preserved in jars, and insects and mollusk shells and all sorts of things. So my job now is much more diverse than just paleontology and dinosaurs, even though dinosaurs and paleontology is, you know, my true original passion.
You are still writing research papers, aren't you?
I do, but I do that all in my own time as well.
All dinosaurs are cool, but everybody knows that the Tyrannosaurus Rex is the coolest. He's the king of the dinosaurs. Why is this species so interesting?
So T-Rex is probably the most famous dinosaur as well. So there's lots of other dinosaurs that are maybe just as big as T-Rex or even bigger, but they're not as well known as T-Rex. So this is because T-Rex has a very long history. It was discovered very, very early on in the discovery of dinosaurs. And so it's got a long history so that people are familiar with. T-Rex is just on the radar. And because it has this very long history, it has been depicted many, many times in pop culture, in movies like Jurassic Park and Fantasia, in many books and pictures and stories. And so it's just a famous dinosaur. And then, of course, if you think about T-Rex as an animal, it is just a spectacular, amazing creature. It's difficult to believe that these things were real. They're almost like fictional monsters, but they were alive and they were roaming around this earth that we're living on now. So I think they have that fascination because they're like a like a monster, but they also are real, which makes them doubly interesting, I think.
I'm writing a blog post about this, sort of tracks T-Rex's history in both kind of paleontology but also popular culture. And it was definitely, timing was a big thing in it becoming such a well-known dinosaur, because there are bigger dinosaurs, there are bigger tyrannosaurs even. There are similar tyrannosaurs that have been subsequently discovered, but because it was found about 100 years ago, and that was about the same time that they started making movies or films that you could see at the cinema, that was a really fortunate bit of timing. So very, very quickly after it was discovered, within 5 years, I think, the first film with a T-Rex in it came out. And the same person who animated that, what's called stop motion animation, where they build a model of a T-Rex and they move it a tiny bit and then take a picture and then move it a tiny bit and take a picture, like Wallace and Gromit is made. Same person who did that film, did the animation for it, also did the animation for a film called King Kong, which was a huge success all over the world. And in that film, King Kong has a fight with a T-Rex. And that really cemented T-Rex in people's imagination as a big, scary monster. And as Adam said, it then appeared in Fantasia, which was a Disney film, and Disney, everybody loves Disney. So it got its foot in the door at the right time, just as screen media was beginning to take off. So I think that's a big part of it.
Chloe, I think you're just about old enough to watch the 1933 King Kong. I still love that movie. I remember seeing it when I was a kid, and even though obviously by, you know, our standards, the special effects are dated, they're still amazing. One kind of theory I've always wondered about is that if a lot of our early myths and legends about monsters were just from accidental amateur paleontologists, like if you look at a mammoth skull, it looks like a cyclops to me. And I wonder if someone found a mammoth skull and thought, oh, that looks like there's one giant eye in the middle. That must be this giant man with this eye. You know, or when someone found a T-Rex skull, how could you not think it was a dragon?
That is certainly likely the origin of some myths. So the Cyclops and that connection to the mammoth skull, I think that is in fact true. I think that the myth of the Cyclops did come from there. There's also been a suggestion that the myth of the griffin, which is another mythological creature, came from the very early discovery of a small dinosaur related to Triceratops that lived in Mongolia and China, called Protoceratops. It's quite small, the size of a sheep, and it's got a beak, and very superficially our picture of a griffin looks a little bit like a Protoceratops. So there have been suggestions, although there's no proof that it's true, that maybe that myth came from a dinosaur skeleton. The first prehistoric reptiles were only discovered in the early 1800s and were recognised for what they were, prehistoric animals, but before then dinosaur bones would have certainly been found, and people would have really been confused about what they were. So you can certainly see them being interpreted as the bones of mythical creatures, and the source of many, like you say, myths and legends that survive today.
This book does a spectacular job of explaining the current scientific understanding of what tyrannosaurs might have looked like. But I also noticed that it's a pretty good primer on the scientific method. So using this storybook, I was able to explain to Chloe what a hypothesis is, how data is collected, how the hypothesis is tested, and how what we regard as facts are refined over time as we gather new information. When you two wrote this book, how explicit was your plan to teach children about the scientific method?
So that was very deliberate. The first book, The Plesiosaur's Neck, although the book is about plesiosaurs and you learn lots of facts about plesiosaurs, I know Adam was very keen with that we got across that this is one of the ways that science works. You come up with a hypothesis and then you have to find evidence to say how likely that hypothesis is to be true. And Plesiosaur's Neck, we just show lots of different hypotheses as to why plesiosaurs had such a long neck. And we were thinking about what we might do for a second book. And in the end, I sort of came up with the idea of doing Tyrannosaurus just because I was so struck by how different the images of Tyrannosaurus today, the ones that you'll find that have been produced perhaps in the last 5 or 10 years, are with the sort of Tyrannosaurs that my son knew about 25 years ago when he was about 4 or 5. And in particular, he had two Tyrannosaur toys that look nothing like we now think tyrannosaurs look like. And I thought that's an interesting thing as well. So to actually say, you know, you come up with a hypothesis and you've got the evidence to support it, and it gives you an idea of how a prehistoric creature might have looked, but new evidence is coming in all the while. You're finding more fossils, perhaps developing more scientific methods. And as that new evidence comes in, it might alter your view. It might even contradict some of the things that you thought. So very famously with T-Rex, it used to be thought that it was standing upright for no real good reason, to be honest. As evidence came in and they examined, for instance, the way that the hip bones connect with the pelvis, I've got to be careful when I'm using scientific phrases around Adam, that suggested that actually T-Rex was much more horizontal, held its spine horizontally, and that was one of the sort of big changes in its appearance. So that was very much the idea, and I thought that's really good because A, it's about T-Rexes, everybody loves T-Rexes, but B, it illustrates how science works in the same way that the first book did.
Yeah, on that, something else that we deliberately did, we noticed that most existing children's books about dinosaurs are all about the facts. They're all about what we know about dinosaurs. And the reality is that there's probably much more that we don't know, or we're still in the process of discovering. So I think both the plesiosaur's neck and the tyrannosaur's feathers focus on this question of what we don't know about dinosaurs as much as what we do know. So we sort of turning things a bit upside down in that regard.
There's a bit at the end of Tyrannosaurus Feathers that each of the information boxes in the book has a little heading, and the final one says to be continued. And I won't say who it is, but we showed the book to somebody at that time and they said, do you really want to say that, you know, this is not the definite way that T-Rex looks, because then it could go out of date? You're just kind of revealing that you're giving something that has got a sell-by date. But that's absolutely fundamental to what we were trying to do in that book. So, you know, it may well be in 10 years' time, somebody does another book like The Tyrannosaurus Feathers, and they say, weren't the people silly for thinking, you know, that it looked like this, when in fact it had wings, because we've now found five dinosaurs. I mean, Adam's looking at me because he knows it's never going to happen. But we've now found five tyrannosaur fossils with wings, and the other ones must just broken off or something.
I have to tip my hat to you for the trick you pull with the character I've named the pedantic velociraptor. All through the story, he's very picky about the inaccuracies in the tyrannosaur's appearance. And the first time I read the book, I was thinking, well, this guy is kind of up on his high horse, and he's probably not so accurate himself, but you both outsmarted me, because right at the end, the tables are turned on pedantic velociraptor, and he gets a makeover, accompanied by an explanation of what we currently know about what velociraptors might have looked like. So I suppose this is less of a question and more of a compliment. Well played, gentlemen.
When we decided we were going to do Tyrannosaurus in the second book, we were wondering whether we could do it as in rhyme like we did with the first book, because that's definitely one of the things that makes the first book appealing. But when I thought about what we needed to do, the kind of information that we wanted to sort of package alongside it, you know, I decided this dialogue between two dinosaurs was better, and therefore I needed a kind of like professor character, if you like, that sort of gives the T-Rex the makeover. And almost straight away, it occurred to me that Velociraptor was the ideal candidate, because so many people have this unrealistic image of Velociraptor due to the Jurassic Park movies, because a lot of people hadn't even heard of Velociraptors until the Jurassic Park movies came out. And they are great films, the first film in particular, but their depiction of Velociraptor is extremely misleading, to say the least.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that T-Rex isn't the only dinosaur that has changed drastically. So Velociraptor is another one. But all dinosaurs have, really, except for the ones that have been discovered in the last like few years, the last decade or so, every dinosaur has gone through a makeover. So it isn't just T-Rex that's changed.
Can we look forward to more dinosaur books from you in the future?
I think we'd love to do another one. I mean, Adam and I have discussed what we might do for the next book, and we have an idea, which I think we need to keep under wraps for now, but we'll probably break the pattern of the plesiosaur's neck, the tyrannosaur's feathers, and do something that's a little bit different, so it won't be the
Diplodocus's feet or something like that. But no, we're very keen to carry on working together.
That's a good idea.
I think whenever this is a great thing about working with Adam is you can just make this tiny sort of casual comment and Adam has got this encyclopedic knowledge. And,
you heard it here, folks. Yeah. Coming soon, the Diplodocus's feet.
There you go. The other thing I was thinking that because you have such a broad knowledge of natural history, so we might even go beyond prehistoric animals at some point.
I certainly hope so. Yeah, we work really well together. Yeah. I think we have such different backgrounds that really complement each other on books like these.
It's probably worth mentioning actually, because sometimes when I read reviews of our books, there's an assumption that Adam does the science and I do the picture book element, or you know, I sort of kiddify it. But we actually work very much both in each other's sort of areas. So I said with the Plesiosaur's Neck, Adam actually did the first draft of that book as a rhyming text, and then I came along and sort of chopped and changed it around. But at the same way, I will often suggest a kind of science bit that we can put in the book, and quite often Adam will say, can't say that because it's not right, or he might just say, come up with this amazing list of facts. And at the end of the day, we both kind of, you know, because we both understand what the other one is trying to do, we work really well as a team. But when it comes to the crunch, if the science isn't right, Adam has final say on that because his name is on the front of the book and he's a scientist. And if I feel that it's perhaps not really right for the age group that we're writing for, then I tend to have final say on that as well. And when working with an illustrator, you know, there are definitely times when we have to say, okay, that's the illustrator's license if they want to do it that way, you know. So I think teams that work like that, where you understand what the other person is trying to do and can contribute to it, but you know, you're able to also back off at the appropriate point. I think that's a great way to work as a team.
Jonathan Emmett and Adam Smith, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having us on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Please subscribe and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters@childrensliterature.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend.
Thanks for listening.